This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, July 15th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle. KUAF is supported by Arcom Printing, located on the hillside just east of the Township and College intersection in Fayetteville. Arcom Printing provides printing, copying, and digital output services. ArcomPrinting.com or 444-7711. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, what it means for a Berryville hospital to have a level 3 trauma ranking, plus a conversation with Fort Smith native and sculptor Robin Horn, who presented lectures in the listening area over the weekend. Also, a serendipitous event that occurred last Friday, a recap of last week's business headlines from Roby Brock, and more. But first, Friday, a former Arkansas Lottery security official pleaded guilty to stealing and cashing almost $500,000 worth of tickets. The lottery suspended Ramel Mazik in October and fired him 3 weeks later. Mazik pleaded guilty to wire fraud and money laundering charges Friday in federal court. Lottery director Bishop Woosley says they are now working to make sure this can't happen again.
I think there's probably lots of fault to go around in the agency. What we're trying to do is review all internal procedures and determine if there was anything we missed. Obviously, the federal investigation documents we've not seen yet. We'll review those and continue to review our procedures internally and determine whether or not there were any other ways that anything like this could have happened. But for now, we've suspended the promotional status and stop giving away any promotional tickets.
Woosley says he was mortified and angry after learning about the thefts, which began shortly after the games began in September of 2009. The Arkansas Lottery says its insurer would cover the losses. Arkansas 4th District Congressman Tom Cotton says splitting up the Farm Bill and delaying a decision on funding for the nation's food stamp program was the right move for Congress. In a partisan vote last week, the House approved the Farm Bill without any provision for food stamps, the first time in 40 years that the assistance program has been absent from a Farm Bill. Speaking yesterday with Roby Brock on Capitol View on Little Rock's KATV, Cotton says a separate bill for food stamps will be discussed later in the year. He called for reform targeting abuses in the system, citing anecdotal evidence that the system is flawed.
Right now, we've all been in a situation where we stand in the grocery line at Walmart or at Berkshire's, and someone has steak in their basket, yet they have a brand new iPhone and they're going out to a brand new SUV, when families are struggling to put hamburger on the table for their own families, and the person with the steak is using a food stamp card.
When Roby Brock pointed out that as many as 42,000 households in Cotton's district, or roughly 16%, receive food stamp benefits, Cotton deflected the notion that he was turning his back on his constituency.
A lot of people in that 16%, which is roughly in line with the national average, do need food stamps. Now, that's a dynamic number. Households come in and out as they move from job to job, and that's where we want to target the aid. But we all know there is some waste and some abuse in that program. You see this in so many government programs. The money is not going to the people who need it most. So we want to reform the program so the rules are going to be more targeted and get it exactly to those who need it most.
Also during the interview, Congressman Cotton didn't give definitive clues as to whether he would challenge Mark Pryor in a race for the U.S. Senate next year. At its meeting this week, the Fayetteville City Council is expected to award a construction phase engineering contract for the extension of Frisco Trail South from Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard to Walker Park. Garver LLC, the firm that managed the project's design phase, is set to receive the management contract. With a tunnel to be built below Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, Alderman Matthew Petty says the project has quite a sizable price tag.
Almost $1.5 million, but most of it came from a grant from the Walton Family Foundation. So the city is only putting up about $200,000 of that ourselves.
Garver is set to receive $109,000 for construction phase engineering services on top of the $216,000 already contracted for design services. The Fayetteville City Council meets tomorrow night at 6. Portions of Sang Avenue in Fayetteville will be closed throughout the week as crews work on street improvements. The work is set to take place between Cleveland Street and Weddington Drive, and through tomorrow, crews will work on replacing the asphalt overlay. From Wednesday through Friday, crews will replace an asphalt speed table with one made of concrete. Detour signs will be in place for 24 hours while the concrete cures. Several programs at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville will benefit from a $100,000 contribution recently made to the university by Phillips 66. According to the university, $70,000 will go toward programs in the Walton College of Business, including the Supply Chain Management Research Center, Information Technology Research Institute, Accounting Department, and two minority scholarships. The other $30,000 is tapped to go to the College of Engineering to support the Engineering Career Awareness Program and to support programs for students and faculty in the Computer Science and Computer Engineering departments. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals had a disappointing weekend of play. The Nats finished up a four-game homestand against the Springfield Cardinals, losing three of the games, including a 4-0 loss Friday and a 7-4 loss on Saturday. The Naturals yesterday began a four-game road series against Tulsa, falling to the Drillers in that first game 6-5. Play continues this evening in Tulsa. Tonight, there is a 30% chance of showers in the early evening, with lows from 64 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 71 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Partly sunny tomorrow with a 40% chance of showers and highs in the mid to upper 80s. Mostly cloudy tomorrow night with a 40% chance of evening showers and lows from 66 in northwest Arkansas to 73 in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. If you're in a severe car accident, getting the appropriate care in a timely manner is critical, which is one of the reasons that the Arkansas Trauma Network was created. This network ranks hospitals on the level of trauma services they provide. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis recently discovered that only one hospital in Carroll County is capable of providing comprehensive trauma care to patients, and he has this report.
Mercy Hospital in Berryville recently announced that it was a Level 3 trauma center, although the designation has been in place since October 2011. Hospitals that are part of the statewide trauma network are placed on one of four levels based upon what services the hospital provides. Whereas a Level 4 trauma center typically stabilizes a patient before transferring him or her to a more equipped facility, a Level 1 trauma center has staff and equipment available to provide comprehensive care for the most serious of injuries. While the closest Level 1 trauma center is in Springfield, Missouri, and the only Level 2 trauma center in Northwest Arkansas's Washington Regional Medical Center in Fayetteville, there are several Level 3 trauma centers throughout the state, but the only one in Carroll County is Mercy Hospital in Berryville. Dr. Milo Warner, the hospital's trauma medical director and emergency room director, says that a Level 3 trauma center must still have comprehensive medical services available at all times.
Trauma designation requires that we have surgery and anesthesia available on a 24/7 basis. The idea being that if a trauma victim presents to our hospital, we are going to stabilize that victim and transfer them to the higher center of care if the patient is stable. If the patient is not stable, we have the ability to stabilize the patient with surgery and anesthesia and then transfer him on to the higher level of trauma services.
Hospitals that are part of the state trauma network receive appropriations from the state to assist in training personnel or improving equipment, all in the name of providing appropriate care. Based on its designation as a Level 3 trauma center, Mercy Berryville received more than $176,000 for fiscal year 2013, much of which Dr. Warner says went toward training costs for hospital staff.
Physicians are all required now to be trained in the American Trauma Life Support. Like most small hospitals in Arkansas, most of our physicians are family physicians that work in the emergency room. So the state requires that they all be trained in Advanced Trauma Life Support, which is the American College of Surgeons program designed for non-surgeons who are evaluating and taking care of trauma patients. We also, as part of the state program, are required to have a bedside ultrasound called a FAST exam. And, sir, the physicians have all been trained on how to use the FAST exam for a rapid evaluation of a trauma abdomen.
But physicians aren't the only ones at Mercy Berryville who received additional training to maintain the Level 3 trauma designation. Nurses, too, received continuing training. Cindy Sellover is the hospital's emergency department director and trauma program manager.
The education is huge for the nurses. Financially, it's difficult to get a large group of nurses educated because it does cost a considerable amount of money. And with the grant money from the state, that allows us not only to buy the equipment that we need, but to educate our nurses. So we have done a tremendous amount of educating this year, thanks to the Arkansas Trauma Program.
But while a Level 3 trauma center can take care of a variety of medical emergencies, Dr. Warner says that there are specific areas that Mercy Berryville can't address as a predominantly rural hospital.
We don't have neurosurgery, cardiac surgery, thoracic surgery, and, you know, there are some orthopedic cases that are done, like, only in Little Rock. For instance, a acetabular fracture. There's only one place in the state you can get those done. So there's, you know, lots of things with major trauma that a Level 3 can't do. The idea is to get the patient stabilized, save their life, and then get them transferred down for definitive care.
And getting patients the appropriate care is something that Michelle Gann, the hospital's vice president for patient services, says has been a goal with the hospital's push to be a part of the statewide trauma network.
We always saw these types of patients. They've come to us for years because if you get injured, they come, you know, to their closest emergency department. So we've always seen them. But in the past, it was perhaps not with the additional equipment that we've been able to purchase with the trauma grants. It was without the network, sort of as a safety net underneath us, helping to transfer the patient to the most appropriate definitive care facility.
That organization is something that Dr. Warner says came late to Arkansas. Formed by the Arkansas General Assembly in Act 393 of 2009, Warner says that the state's trauma system was one of the last to be developed in the country. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Job hires, job layoffs, and new information on the Pegasus Pipeline burst. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas has the details in his weekly business news recap.
A report regarding the pipeline burst that led to the Mayflower oil spill has been received by a federal agency. And while the report has not been made public, ExxonMobil officials who have seen it claim manufacturing defects were responsible for the break. The Pegasus pipeline was built in the late 1940s. Serco, an information and technology service provider, will locate a new processing facility in Rogers this fall. Publicly traded Serco learned last week that it landed a $1.25 billion healthcare contract with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Serco will manage applications for health insurance plans related to the Affordable Care Act. Rogers city officials said Serco is expected to bring at least 600 jobs to the area. Hewlett-Packard is laying off around 500 workers in Conway as it streamlines its operations at its three-year-old $28 million customer support facility and abroad. The Palo Alto, California-based computer firm opened its Conway Service Center in 2010 amid tremendous fanfare. Metropolitan National Bank is expected to be acquired by a limited liability company tied to a Dallas billionaire banker, Gerald Ford. The privately held Little Rock Bank will change ownership after a Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceeding of its current shareholder group, Rogers Bank Shares, which was the holding company for the bank under the leadership of businessman Doyle Rogers. He died in February at the age of 94. Home Bank Shares subsidiary Centennial Bank announced that Davy Carter will serve as regional president. Carter, the current Arkansas Speaker of the House, left the bank earlier this year but returned after the session. Centennial says Carter's duties and responsibilities will include oversight of its recent $280 million Liberty Bank acquisition. Arkansas Economic Development Commission Director Grant Tenniel says the state should undo its constitutional restriction on gay marriage. Speaking at a press conference earlier this week to unveil new state poll results from the Human Rights Campaign, which is a civil rights organization working to achieve equality for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Americans, Grant Tenniel said Arkansas should treat all of its citizens equally under the law. A federal judge on Tuesday rescheduled the trial of former state treasurer Martha Shaffner, who faces bribery and extortion charges. U.S. District Judge Leon Holmes rescheduled the trial, which had been set for July 29th to March 3rd of 2014. In a one-page order issued Tuesday, Holmes said Shaffner's attorney, Chuck Banks, requested a continuance. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Arkansas update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas and Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. More at AECC.com. It is Monday, July 15th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
You know how we always talk about time flying?
Yes.
Time has flown again.
I know.
Because Opera in the Ozarks is wrapping up their summer.
It's ridiculous.
They have a variety of music this week. Chamber music tonight at 7:30 at Holiday Island Community Church, and that's free.
Oh.
Famous opera scenes tomorrow night at Inspiration Point, that's $20 to $25, 7:30 again. A Taste of Opera, presented by Opera in the Ozarks, of course, at 6 o'clock Wednesday at the Crescent Hotel in Eureka Springs. Food and opera.
Sounds yummy.
$50. Madam Butterfly at 7:30 Wednesday at Inspiration Point. Pirates of Penzance on Thursday. And the last show is Elixir of Love at 7:30 on Friday. Check it all out at opera.org or 800-595-4849.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Have you ever asked yourself, am I going crazy?
The notion is that if you see things or hear things, you're going mad. But as a physician, I have to try and define what's going on and to reassure people that they're not going insane.
I'm Guy Raz, the place between madness and sanity. It's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The TED Radio Hour, Sunday at noon, here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Hey, all you young people over 40, don't be feeling low. They say life begins at 80, you still have a long ways to go.
Monroe County native and rhythm and blues pioneer Louis Jordan's musical influence is broad. So broad, it extends to performers considered to be musical innovators themselves. Chuck Berry, James Brown, B.B. King. Ray Charles was another Jordan acolyte and covered several Jordan songs, such as Early in the Morning, Let the Good Times Roll, Choo 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 Boogie, and had a hit with Jordan's song, Don't Let the Sun Catch You Crying.
Wait every day, but here is the thing to do. Change your mind. Old age ain't nothing but a matter of time.
By the early 1960s, Ray Charles's star had risen to the point where he rated his own Vanity record label. In contrast, Louis Jordan of Brinkley hadn't had a hit since the early 1950s. By 1961, Jordan had even disbanded his backing group, the Timpani Five, was without a recording contract and working as a guest star with other groups. So the offer to record for Charles's new record label, Tangerine, must have been welcome news to Jordan and his fans.
When I come home in the evening, you better have my dinner hot. I want to smell that old pot roast while it's stewing in the pot. Have my bubble bath waiting and my change of clothes laid out. And when I ask you to light my cigarette, give me a smile and don't you pout. Hothead! You heard just what I said. Black Dick, if you don't straighten up, baby, there's gonna be some changes made.
On his sessions for Tangerine Records, Louis Jordan recorded with the big band that recorded with Ray Charles, and most of the arrangements were by Ernie Freeman. Several singles and an album called Hallelujah, Louis Jordan is Back were issued on Charles's label. Unlike the low points of his post-1940s recordings, Louis Jordan isn't trying to redo his classic hits with a rock and roll backbeat. But Jordan did pull out his food song Coleslaw, an obscurity he originally recorded in 1949, which extols the benefits of the cabbage dish as served in his home state. Jordan also audaciously does a version of What I Say, an important hit for Ray Charles, just a few years before.
Yeah, see the girl with the snaggle tooth. She hardly ever tell the truth what I say. I tell me what I say.
Although Louis Jordan was happy with the music from the Tangerine sessions, he was not with the music's distribution, which was handled by Ray Charles's home label, the huge corporation ABC Paramount. Jordan told of bringing copies to disc jockeys himself and taking the album to sell at shows while on tour with Moms Mabley. Even years later, Jordan complained to interviewers that DJs had played the Tangerine material, but consumers could not find the records in stores. I think he must have signed me up as a tax deduction or something, Louis Jordan said of Ray Charles. Jordan's widow, Martha, agreed that Jordan could never understand why Charles, in their eyes, did not push the Jordan records after being aggressive and getting him to sign to Tangerine. Louis Jordan's affiliation with Ray Charles's Tangerine label ended in 1964. Other notables on the label include Percy Mayfield, who wrote Ray Charles's smash song Hit the Road, Jack, Ike and Tina Turner, and the Ohio Players. Charles's female singers, the Raylettes, also recorded for Tangerine. The leader of the Raylettes for many years was Mabel John, who was raised in Ouachita County. Tangerine Records folded when Ray Charles left ABC Paramount in 1973. By then, Louis Jordan was in Paris, recording for another label what would be his last album. Louis Jordan died February 4th, 1975. Here in its entirety is Louis Jordan on Tangerine Records with Never Know When a Woman Changes Her Mind, one of his four singles on Ray Charles's label from the early 1960s, written by Floyd Dixon.
Came home this morning about 3:30, and my baby had walked out on me. A woman will love many, trust very few. 'Cause when you fall in love, they'll walk out on you. As I go through life, here's what I find. You never know when a woman's gonna change.
since the beginning of Adam and Eve, the man has suffered and he has grieved. But there's one secret no doctor can find. That's to tell when a woman gonna change her mind.
Never Know When a Woman Changes Her Mind by Louis Jordan of Brinkley in Monroe County on Ray Charles's Tangerine label. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. Last week, Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville was the site of the Distance Learning Summit. The three-day event featured not only local professional educators, but also representatives from places like the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Smithsonian American Art Museum, discussing successes and failures in creating and implementing distance learning programs. The summit was sponsored by the Wingate Charitable Foundation. Arkansas native Robin Horn is the foundation's board president as well as a sculptor. One of the artist's wooden pieces, titled Already Set in Motion, is part of Crystal Bridges' permanent collection and is located on a small lawn behind the gift shop. Robin says having her work being a part of the collection is probably the best thing that's ever happened in her career. The artist was in town last week for the summit, and she gave a lecture on her piece yesterday afternoon at the museum. While she was in town, I stopped by the museum to chat with her about her artwork. The Fort Smith native, who currently lives in Little Rock, was not always a sculptor. She trained as a painter at Hendricks College in Conway and even spent some time as chief photographer for the Arkansas Department of Parks and Tourism. During our conversation, I asked Robin how she transitioned from a painter and photographer to a sculptor.
The painting that I had done was kind of minimal. My mother is a painter, and so she was always painting, and it was interesting to see her working, and so it felt kind of normal to me to do that. So that's why I got an art degree at Hendricks. And later on, when I was doing photography for Parks and Tourism, that was nice too, but it wasn't really the thing that I was meant to be doing, evidently. So my brother-in-law, Sam, went to Aramont School in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, and he took a class in wood turning from David Ellsworth, who is a vase guru. He makes wood vases on a lathe, which is kind of a tricky technique, and he developed a lot of tools and things. So Sam came back from the week that he spent there and showed me what he had learned. So he said, "You want to try it?" And I did. And so I made things on the lathe for a while, which is, if you're not familiar with it, it's a mechanical apparatus that spins a piece of wood. You hold a cutting tool against a real solid bar and remove wood. So it's how you make a bowl, how you make a spindle. So it's a really effective tool in making things round. So I made round things for a while. Then I got tired of round things, so I started doing more carving and got away from the lathe a little bit. That was when I started the Standing Stone series, which were influenced by Barbara Hepworth's work. She's an English sculptor who was around in the mid-20th century and was overshadowed a bit by Henry Moore, who got a lot more publicity than she did. But her work is more interesting to me than his is. And she has a large sculpture in front of the United Nations building, which is quite stupendous to me. She's just really was a influential sculptor in my career. So I started doing the Standing Stone series, and then the Slipping Stone series came after that, which is what this piece is all about.
Somewhere along the way, I think in 97, you started an organization for wood art. Was there not one before that, and why did you do that?
I was talking to my friend Stoney Lamar, who's in North Carolina. He's a wood artist. And there were a lot of us who were getting into exhibitions, and showing our work here and there in museums or in galleries. And he said, you know, maybe we need a support group to try to cultivate collectors, basically is what it was for. So we called it the Collectors of Wood Art, and artists were members too. And so we had gatherings and we put together trips so that people could go see artist studios, that type of thing. And it was pretty effective all along throughout our careers. There's a group of us who have been working in wood that have gotten to be really tight, really close friends over the last 20 years, and you know, they become family, and it's really great to see the artist's growth. You know, I look at my work too and see how it's changed over the years and how important that is to your career. You can't just keep doing the same thing over and over again and feel successful, you know, feel like you're doing what you need to do. I would get real bored with it. So changing series is what really helps me to investigate a particular form and determine whether it's something you want to continue for a while or if you need to move on to the next one. And it's fun to try different things with the different ones. You know, it's an exploration. Your career just becomes an exploration. And I didn't start out thinking I'm going to be an artist. I'm going to be a famous artist or something. You know, you start out just making things. And you make them because you love to make them. And you get into a show or two and you get excited about that. And it kind of spurs you on to do more things. And, you know, before you know it, that's what you are. You're an artist. And it's kind of hard to admit it to yourself at first. That, you know, you're kind of thinking, you know, how did this happen? But it's kind of a good feeling to be able to say, I'm an artist.
Well, you are an artist and you are a sculptor of wood. What is it about the medium of wood that you seem to enjoy?
The wood seems to work for me best because it's so direct. When you cut the wood, it's cut. And you make these decisions and you do the cuts, make the cuts with whatever tool you're making or carving with. And it just seems to be, because it's a subtractive process, something that appeals to me rather than additive, like even furniture. You know, making furniture with wood is an additive process. You make the pieces and then you hook them together somehow, assemble them somehow. So removing the material, which would be similar to stone carving or something like that, is just what appeals to me. And I guess it's because those are processes that I've been able to get enough of a feel for that I can get it to respond to me in the way I want it to. I can make the cuts where I want to make the cuts, and I can make the surface look like the surface that I want it to. So that's, I guess, the reason that wood works so well for me. Plus, wood's beautiful, and there's a lot of it around. You can use wood easily, find plenty of material to use, so it's a good material for me.
In working with that material, you tend to work with a chainsaw. That seems very unwieldy compared to, say, a pencil or a paintbrush, and also heavy.
It's not really all that heavy to use one. It's a little bit physical to cut with one, but it's also, I guess maybe it's aggressive. And one side is side where I want a cut to be, I want to make the cut aggressively. I don't want to ease into it, or, you know, I want it to be definitive. I want it to be very decisive. So the chainsaw is the best tool to use for something that's very large to cut it. There's really no other good way to make those cuts. And if you're careful with a chainsaw, it's not a scary tool to use. Once you get proficient with it, you feel like you have control over it. And I don't use huge chainsaws most of the time unless I'm cutting a really large piece that has to, you know, just have a straight cut or something. Most of the time you're using a smaller carving chainsaw. They have made chainsaws now that have a real small tip on the end, and they made them for ice carving, for carving sculptures when they're carving ice. And they work really well on wood too. so they don't have the kickback that a normal chainsaw has. So it's a very safe way to do it, and I'm very careful. I don't let my attention stray when I'm using it. I'm very focused on what I'm doing. So those are important aspects of, you don't want to get hurt because then you couldn't work. So you don't want that to happen.
During our visit at the museum, Robin and I walked outside to view our piece. Already set in motion is a tall, dark gray wooden structure situated in the middle of bright green grass, trees, and a couple of silver metal benches. Stationed in between the trees, the artwork seems like it belongs there, perhaps because it too is made from wood and appears to be stretching skyward. Part of the piece mimics falling stones that seem to be impossibly suspended in the air. The artwork was installed on the grounds about a month before the museum opened in November of 2011.
This is a piece from my Slipping Stone series, and it's carved from a single piece of redwood with a chainsaw, and it's made to look as though it's assembled. That's the main idea of this series, is to make something look like it's cascading down, out of balance, about to fall, when in fact it's a good solid piece of wood. It just has negative spaces in it to make it look a little bit lighter. It has components on it that I refer to as stones. Most of my work has a reference to stones. I have made geodes and millstones and standing stones, and so this is my latest series. And I've done a lot of smaller ones. This is one of the first 10 feet tall ones that I've made.
So how long did it take you to work on this piece, and how do you even begin to approach something that's 10 feet tall?
This is a half of a piece of redwood that was 5 feet in diameter. So I split it lengthwise down the middle, so it's then 2.5 feet by 10 feet. So it's a half of a log. And at that point, I draw on it with chalk. I knew what I wanted to make. I had made a smaller one that was what I would use as a maquette to make this piece, so I knew the design that I wanted to make. So I started drawing on the wood with chalk and markers to get the arrangement just right within the limits of the material that I had. So it's not pieced together, it's all solid, and it's just carved to look like it's pieced together.
Is that more difficult than piecing it together?
Not for me. For me, piecing it together would be very difficult, and making it stay together. This way I feel like it's sturdier. It has the solidity of the wood in between the pieces, so it's not nearly as precarious as it looks like it is.
Is there any kind of weather considerations you need to take into account when making this piece? Do you need to weatherize it or put some sort of coating on it to protect it from the elements?
The finish on it is a black aniline dye. If I had just left it with the plain wood finish, it would just look gray. It would eventually go gray. Just wood just weathers to be gray. My concern, as much as anything, was because of the orientation of the piece, it's oriented the way the tree grew. So on top, you have the fibers of the wood, the grain, going upward. And so water could get down into it and just kind of permeate it, basically. So I put a sealer on top of it that's a really good sealer that keeps that from happening, so it keeps the deterioration down. Redwood is a little more impervious to bugs than a lot of wood, so it's a good wood to use outside. And then the aniline dye that I used has an oil base to it, so that's another protection on top of that. It will need to be refinished eventually. It'll start looking faded a little bit and start looking gray. So there is maintenance involved, but it's pretty durable, more so than you would think.
Can you tell me a little bit about the title for the piece, Already Set in Motion?
I have done a lot of slipping stones, and most of the titles are suggesting movement. The whole series is about movement and balance and geometry and negative spaces, and I just thought that sounded like it was getting ready to fall, getting ready to move, and that will be a good name for it.
What do you hope that people take away from coming and looking at this piece of art?
As an artist, what you hope is that it will grab someone's attention for a short period of time, that they will consider it. I also like the fact that it looks like it's assembled when it's not. So maybe they'll go over and check it out to see how it's made, to determine whether it's been bolted together or something, you know, when it hasn't. So messing with people's heads is really kind of fun too. And that, you know, you get more attention when somebody's looking at it if they can't quite figure it out. If they get it figured out immediately upon looking at it, then they move on. So maybe there's just some confusion about it. That's all I'm going for.
Robin Horn is the Wingate Charitable Foundation's board president, as well as the creator of the wooden sculpture titled Already Set in Motion. The piece is installed on the grounds of Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art and is part of the museum's permanent collection. More information about the artist is available at Robin Horn, that's robynhorn.com. This is Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. Sometimes the universe clicks and a wonderful serendipitous event takes place. As Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kelms tells us, last Friday there was just such an occurrence.
Welcome. We're so glad you're here, Bob. My name's Julie Gable. Nice to meet you. Glad to have you here. Hi.
Last Friday afternoon, a summer camp session of Trike Theater was wrapping up at Nadine Baum Studios in Fayetteville. About a dozen young actors were getting ready to sing their way through a production of Schoolhouse Rock for their parents, the musical they had been working on for the past several days. Since most of the young performers appeared to be under the age of 15, it's a safe assumption their parents grew up watching the Schoolhouse Rock songs about multiplication, civics, science, and language as well. Like Conjunction Junction, here in a final dress rehearsal before the performance on Friday. In 1973, the Schoolhouse Rock songs began airing on network television. They taught millions of baby boomers and their younger siblings and their children, and perhaps their grandchildren, how to remember their multiplication tables. That the songs still resonate with kids 40 years later is a testimony to the timelessness of the music. Now, here's the wonderful coincidence of last Friday. In town that very day was the man who wrote most of the memorable Schoolhouse Rock songs, Bob Doro. When Trike Theater selected the show for their camp, they had no idea he was going to be scheduled to be here. Nor did the concert promoters know that Trike Theater had been licensed to present the music. Everybody concerned only did find out about 48 hours before this rehearsal. What are the odds? Somebody asked. But there, sitting in the front row, was Bob Doro. He's 80 years older than some of the children on stage, but the songs he wrote are some of their favorites. As the kids were singing it, just a few feet away, he was beaming, bouncing up and down and mimicking their choreography, singing along.
Junction, junction, what's your function?
During his nearly hour-long visit with the Trike Theater cast, he answered their questions, like if Schoolhouse Rock was his idea.
No, my boss, he thought of it. And he had money to give me. So when I wrote three, he loved it, and he, what?
What instruments do you play?
Piano, recorder. I used to play saxophone and clarinet. Not so much anymore.
What inspired you to make the songs?
Oh, well, just the chance to communicate with children. You know, it was supposed to be it was just a recording, not a TV show. They wanted to make a record and give it to kids and pass it out to libraries and schools. And, you know, it seemed like a great opportunity for me to meet a lot of young people through the music.
How do you think we did in the songs that we performed?
Oh, man, you were great. You were great. He plays, he's the rocker.
Yeah.
Where's Tom, that guy? He gets the main part in the play, right?
Yeah.
And you all had something great to do, and the chorus was good. The choreography was great.
Since Bob had heard his music translated by the Schoolhouse Rock cast, the suggestion was made that he sit down at a nearby electronic keyboard in the theater and play one of his songs for them.
And I'll do Figure Eight, because I love it. You want to hear Figure Eight?
Yeah.
The kids sat transfixed, some of them singing along as Bob performed with glee, a song more than four decades old that, yes, teaches how to multiply by eight, but also considers mortality, beauty, and joy. Little three-minute slices of genius, these Schoolhouse Rock songs. They've been covered by mainstream jazz musicians and alternative rock bands and continue to be played in schools. And it was apparent last Friday afternoon that Bob Dorr's music still has an impact on multiple generations.
It wasn't really a question, but I use those multiplication songs to learn my multiples.
She uses them. I learned them too. Yeah. Me too. Yeah, she
to
uses those
arithmetic.
Songs to learn multiplication tables.
Yeah. They work.
Well, my dad couldn't be here today, but he wanted me to thank you for writing that song, I'm Just a Bill, because he never learned that, and he ended up becoming a political scientist. So.
Wow.
Lots of people are learning how our government works through that
song. Sure, exactly.
Bob also treated the youngsters to I'm Just a Bill, and after that, he asked if he could hear one more song before he left.
Want to do one more for me?
The cast picked that first ever Schoolhouse Rock song that Bob wrote, Three is a Magic Number, and Bob Duro again took a front row seat and was obviously having a head-bobbing good time.
You get three as a magic number. The past and the present and the future. Faith and hope and charity.
And it wasn't just the young members of the cast excited about the visit either. Sarah Lear, managing director of Trike Theater, was tapping her toes to the music as well.
So it was just one of those things about Northwest Arkansas, and I think it's one of those, it's a beautiful thing about this area, I really think, honestly, is that you have incredible musicians coming through all the time, and then you have a summer production camp about Schoolhouse Rock, and the composer is here. And what I think is beautiful about just watching him with our students is that the teachers, you know, Miss Julie Gable, very excited to meet Bob Duro. I'm very excited to meet Bob Duro. You know, it's the span of ages. And so we have 8-year-olds who are jumping out of their seat to meet him. And then you have not so 8-year-olds who are also very excited to meet him. And so what a testament to his music that it really appeals to all of these ages. It's timeless. Education is timeless. And learning through music is just a beautiful way to do it.
I'm so proud.
Yay!
A couple of postscripts to this story. Trike Theater Summer isn't finished. The company's Summer Youth Musical is later this month, July 26th at 7 p.m. and July 27th at 2 in the afternoon at Arend Arts Center in Bentonville. This year's production is Annie Jr.
What we do is the camp is about teaching them all kinds of theater skills, a little bit of tech or a little bit of costuming. They did stage makeup yesterday. I showed up and I saw all kinds of fake bruises and fake blood everywhere. But they get a little bit of taste of everything, not just the production. At the end, you have this great product, but you get a little bit of everything.
That was Sarah Lear, managing director of Trike Theater. And finally, just what are the odds that something like Bob Doro's visit could happen on the exact day when Trike Theater's summer camp was presenting a show of his music, all of it just by chance? To find out exactly what the odds are, we asked for help.
I'm Brian Rickert, and I'm a math instructor at the University of Arkansas.
I gave Brian a couple of numbers to work with, that Bob Duro has been to Northwest Arkansas just a couple of times during his career for a total of no more than a few days. Then I estimated the number of scripts that can be produced by a young cast, counting Shakespeare, Dickens, Disney, all the others, around 500,000.
Well, so what we do from there, since we're assuming these two events are independent, then we look at the probabilities of each event happening, the probability of his script being chosen, and the probability of him being in town on this particular for this particular time period. since these events are independent, we simply find the probabilities and multiply them together and then figure out the odds from there.
Okay, my guess is it's at least one in a million shot.
Yes, it is. It is at least that much. In fact, quite higher. The actual odds are 1 in 270,893,750.
So there you have it. Mathematical proof that Bob Doro's visit with the young cast members of Trike Theater was likely a once-in-a-lifetime event.
Unless they're going to live another 271 million days.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on Here and Now, the Pittsburgh Pirates have had 20 straight losing seasons, but heading into the All-Star break, they have one of the best records in baseball. We'll look at how smart investing could help them end that long losing streak. And can American parents learn anything from moms and dads in Japan? Coming up on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next, right here on KUAF 91.3 FM. The Brett Bielema Swing for the Cure Golf Classic is Friday, July 26th at Shadow Valley Country Club in Rogers. This 18-hole scramble tournament offers morning and afternoon flights, lunch, prizes, and more. Proceeds to benefit Susan G. Komen Ozark. More information is available at komenozark.org. or 750-PINK. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF and the ALMA Performing Arts Center invite you to register for the ALMA PAC 2013-2014 season giveaway. One winner will receive two season tickets, which include a production of the comedy musical 9 to 5 and much more. The drawing is set for Friday, July 19th, that's this Friday, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Registration and information are available at KUAF.com. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Lone Star. Lone Star is located in Carroll County along Highway 23. Couldn't be on your way to Eureka Springs. I got to drive that way this weekend, spent some time at Turpentine Creek, and then headed north on 23 through Lone Star to Eureka Springs and got to finally see a production of Opera of the Ozarks. Got to had the pleasure of watching Elixir of Love. The group will be finishing their summer season this weekend, so this is your last chance to catch some of their productions. They're doing Madama Butterfly, The Elixir of Love, and Pirates of Penzance. If you'd like some more information, you can visit opera.org. One other performance note, tickets went on sale this morning for another concert at the AMP. The Arkansas Music Pavilion will have Easton Corbin with special guest Tyler Farr at the Washington County Fairgrounds site August 17th at 7:30. Gates open at 6. Tickets went on sale this morning, and they range from $27 to $37, and there's some premium seating available for $102. You can find out more by visiting amptickets.com or by calling 443-5600. Also, one quick reminder that WordCamp Fayetteville is scheduled for July 26th through the 28th. Registration is $30, and you can find out more at wcfay.com. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you have a great Monday.